You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hans Blix served as the Director General of the International Atomic Agency Commission from 1981 until 1997, and then as the Executive Chairman of the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission from March 2000 to June 2003. He currently chairs the Swedish government's Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, and he was awarded the Sydney Peace Prize this past May. In the May-June issue of the Boston Review, there was an article by Mr. Blix called Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Arms Control, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
People who grew up during the Cold War are familiar with the term mutually assured destruction, or the phrase, we build nuclear weapons so that we never have to use them. Are those concepts still relevant when we're talking about the current proliferation of nuclear weapons?
Much less so. Actually, early this year, there was an article published by Mr. Kissinger and former Secretary Shultz and Bill Perry and Senator Nunn, and they argued in the Wall Street Journal that the concept of deterrence that was valid during the Cold War is not valid between the great powers any longer, and that the further building of nuclear weapons actually might encourage others to do the same. So it's a different situation today.
Although perhaps it would apply to the standoff between Pakistan and India.
Maybe so. Yes, to some extent in that situation it might have a value. Clearly it is not a value regarding terrorists, and they are not deterred. One may not know where they are, and they would not fear any retribution or counteraction anyway.
What about with the so-called rogue nations like Iran and North Korea? Why would they seek to build nuclear weapons?
Well, in the commission which I chaired, which is an international commission, we were 14 members from all around the world, including Bill Perry, we said that in all cases where you fear proliferation, you have to try to understand what are the things that make the other guy move and what makes them tick. And I think we identified two main motives. One is perceived security, and the other one is recognition, status. We know from history that perceived security has been the dominant reason, not the only reason, but the dominant one. The Chinese developed nuclear weapons for security against the Russians. The Indians developed it because of the Chinese, and the Israelis, of course, because of the Arabs. The case of Libya is a bit more doubtful. I'm not sure that Gaddafi really felt threatened. It might be more a case of recognition of status. The North Koreans probably feel worried about the U.S. And they remember that in the Korean War, the U.S. commanders were asked for authority to use nuclear weapons against Korea, and they actually got it, although they didn't use it. And they have lost their friends in Russia and in China, and so there might be some genuine feeling of insecurity which they have tried to compensate by a nuclear weapon. So this is an important one, and one should keep that in mind also regarding Iran. If they are actually have been thinking and or are thinking of nuclear weapons, it ought to have started with a fear about Iraq, because we see the roots of the Iranian program in the 1980s, and that was the time when they had a war against Iran. Now, the conclusion of that, of course, is that if you want to keep countries off nuclear weapons, then you have to try to arrange their security in some other way.
What about threatening them? For example, why didn't the United States-led invasion of Iraq for its supposed weapons of mass destruction deter Iran and North Korea from continuing to develop their nuclear programs?
Well, some people turn the argument around and say that, look, North Korea has not been attacked, and that's because they may have nuclear weapons, so there may be a greater security in having the nuclear weapons, and that a country like Iran might perhaps rush towards nuclear weapons as a perceived means of security. So I think it cuts both ways, really.
And you suggest in the article that the U.S. invasion actually gave those countries cause to accelerate their WMD programs.
Yeah. That's the argument that has been made. It's also been made vis-a-vis Yugoslavia, that if Yugoslavia had had, if Milosevic had had nuclear weapons, then the NATO would not have attacked them. But it's not really certain. I think, and my commission on the whole advocates more of use of carrots than of sticks. And I think that's precisely what we are seeing in the negotiations with North Korea, which I'm very positive. I think the U.S. has changed its attitude there from more of sticks in the past to more of carrots, and I think that seems more promising. And I think one should see the same in the case of Iran. In the case of Iran, the U.S. attitude has been more mixed. You have both threats and carrots.
Why do you think the United States has been more willing to come to some kind of agreement with North Korea, which is a country that you describe as paranoid, than Iran, which might very well be a bit more reasonable?
Yeah, the North Korea, of course, is in some ways much more dangerous than Iran because they have detonated a device of some kind, so they are much further along the line. The reason for the restraint, I think, on the U.S. side is the awareness that if they really threaten, the North Koreans could use their power. They didn't have to use nuclear weapons. Seoul is within artillery range from North Korea. I was there last year and up at the nuclear and the neutral zone, and it's very, very close. So the North Koreans are too dangerous, and to provoke them would be very, very risky.
So it's simply a matter of North.
So
it's simply a matter of North Korea actually having developed weapons, and so they have to be dealt with more seriously. But you would think that with the possibility of Iran developing weapons, that some kind of diplomatic negotiations would be pursued. Or does it really matter? Because even though the United States hasn't had relations with Iran since 1979 when the U.S. embassy was occupied, all of the European nations continue to have diplomatic relations with it. So there can be backdoor connections, can't there?
Well, the North Koreans were dangerous even before they had tested a device. I mean, they could have used ordinary artillery against Seoul if the U.S. were to attack them. In the case of it, I think the U.S., I think the U.S. has done well in the negotiations and is doing well with negotiations with North Korea because they are responding to what North Koreans voice as concerns, namely what they call a hostility of the U.S. And the U.S. is offering guarantees of security to North Korea and also guarantees about diplomatic relations in case the North Koreans go along with a settlement of the nuclear issue. So it's not only carrots in terms of oil and food, etc., but also these two points. But when you compare that to the case of Iran, you find that these two essential points are missing so far in the negotiations with Iran. To my knowledge, certainly no one has published anything to the effect that the U.S. and the other states should be offering the Iranians any security in return for a settlement of the nuclear issue. Nor has there been any suggestion from the U.S. side that they might have diplomatic relations with the Iranians in return for a settlement of the nuclear issue. There's a big difference.
I'm talking to Hans Blix, who was the executive chairman of the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission from March 2000 to June 2003, long after the United States and Britain invaded Iraq. He's written an article in the Boston Review called Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Arms Control. And so you're suggesting that official U.S. recognition of Iran's government might have a positive effect. And you also write that it might be easier to persuade Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment program if the U.S. would do the same. Now, what makes you think that the Bush administration or even any other American administration would be likely to do something like that?
Well, it's not that one would expect the U.S. to do identically the same as Iran, of course not. But the problem is we see the U.S. discussing a replacement of their nuclear weapons and a further development of bunker busters, etc. We see the British prolonging their nuclear Trident program. So the evolution of the nuclear weapon state is one that is sort of confirming, consolidating the nuclear weapons as part of a future arsenals, while one is asking of Iran and of North Korea that they should stay away from it. And the argument I and many other make is that if the nuclear weapon states show the way and say that we all will want to move away from this as we promised in the 1968 non-proliferation treaty, then that might have a persuasive effect, whereas the demands on Iran sound a little hollow coming from countries that are actually pursuing and continuing their nuclear capabilities.
But looking at it the other way, isn't the Iranian insistence on building a bomb a reason the British renewed their nuclear weapons program well beyond 2020?
No, I don't think so. I think that the British would have gone ahead with that regardless of what the Iranians are doing. The commission I headed agrees with the view that it would be desirable to it is desirable to persuade the Iranians to stay away from enrichment because it would clearly increase the tension in the region. I'm personally rather critical about the manner in which this has been pursued, and notably the difference they have made in the approach to North Korea and the approach to Iran. And I think that many others also feel that to say to the Iran that, look, we will be willing to sit down with you and discuss all kinds of arrangements, but first you must suspend your enrichment. I mean, that's a little disingenuous because the suspension of enrichment is the main object of the negotiation. So I think many like me will say that why don't they sit down and talk about it without any such preconditions?
Well, even if the United States agreed to suspend its uranium enrichment program, there are still other countries that Iran might consider threats, the UK, France, Israel. There's no guarantee that if we made such a striking concession that Iran would respond.
Well, there have been long been proposals for a suspension or ending of enrichment of uranium for weapons purposes and also of reprocessing for plutonium for weapons purposes. And the U.S. has itself advanced proposals in that direction in Geneva not so long ago, but however, without any verification arrangements. And I think that if that line were pursued, that all countries in the world would commit themselves to no enrichment for weapons purposes, that would also be a step towards nuclear disarmament, which would carry some weight with the Iranians. Whether it would suffice, I don't know. The main avenue that has been discussed with regard to Iran and the Middle East in the past has been the establishment of a zone free of weapons of mass destruction. And also the Israelis are voting for that idea practically every year. But we also know that such a concept and such a project is not really feasible except in the context of a peaceful settlement. So that's far away. But the commission I headed came up with another idea that is a little more modest, and that is to suggest a zone free of fuel cycle activities. One would then, the gist of it would be that all the countries in the Middle East would commit themselves to no production of enriched uranium, no enrichment capability, and also no reprocessing. Now, Iran would not be alone. It would also be directed to the Gulf states that say that they would like to start a nuclear program, to Egypt, to Jordan, and other countries that are saying the same. And it would be also be directed to Israel that they would not reprocess more plutonium than they have. And it wouldn't affect their weapons, but it would be a commitment for them not to reprocess more plutonium.
Well, all these proposals in a time that you say that arms control efforts have stagnated, at least in the last decade. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll address that and what's happened with all of the treaties and why they don't seem to have worked very well. As we continue this conversation with Hans Blix, whose article in the Boston Review is Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Arms Control. Stay with us. We're back with Hans Blix, the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. He served as the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency from 1981 to 1997, and as the executive chairman of the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission from March 2000 to June 2003. He's written an article for the Boston Review called Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Arms Control. And before we went to the break, I mentioned that you say that arms control efforts have stagnated over the past decade. Why do you think that is? In fact, it seems to me that little progress has been made in implementing the nuclear disarmament the United States and Russia promised in the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968.
Well, in the 1990s, they certainly reduced their nuclear arsenals. At the peak, there were about 55,000 nuclear warheads in the world, and they've been down to something like 27,000 now. So they've done away with a lot of redundancy. But
that's still 27,000. That's an awful lot.
Yeah. No, that's very... But its redundancy was an incredible number that they had during the Cold War. And for economic and other reasons, I think they've gone down. And the Moscow Treaty that they concluded in 2002 envisages also a further reduction, but there is no verification of it, and it's not actually doing a dismantling the warheads. It's simply to make them not deploy them any longer. So I think it's true to say, as Kofi Annan said the other year, that the world is rather sleepwalking into new arms races. And with the demand for a new nuclear weapon in the U.S. and the Trident in the U.K. and with the Russians developing new missiles and with the Chinese shooting down a weather satellite of their own, and with world military expenses currently around $1.3 trillion a year, about half of that being the U.S., and that is worrisome. We are no longer in a Cold War. One would have expected that we would be able to reduce these expenses and to move out of the nuclear weapon era, to begin to move out of the nuclear weapon era.
How would the current talks between Russia and the U.S. over the Bush administration's plans to put an anti-missile defense in Europe play into this situation?
I think very badly, and we see that the Russians are reacting strongly against it. Of course, we hear from Washington that these are not by any means directed against the Russians. It's only concern about possible Iranian missiles 15 years from now. But from the perspective of Russia and the Ivan in the street, I think that seeing that the U.S. are establishing missile links in Poland and Czech Republic will be seen as a provocation, as something that can be developed in the future. So I think one must have some understanding for the Russian reaction. And they also recognize that one might cooperate about missile defense against possible rogue states, but there's not such a hurry.
Well, Putin has made some plans.
I think the U.S. has also realized that maybe this is a bit provocative, and they are willing to talk about it to reduce the tensions.
Well, Putin has made some kind of offer, but it doesn't really seem like it's going to fly, does it?
No, I have not seen any sign that it would fly. But this is not the only item in the air. Of course, the Russians have felt for a long time that after the end of the Cold War, when they expected a real detente, and when Gorbachev really took great steps in that direction, and President Bush, the elder, also did away with a great deal of tactical nuclear weapons together with Gorbachev, this has not continued, but rather gone back, slid back to more of military development. And right now, I think Washington seems to be a little more open to talks about disarmament. For many years, we have had no work program in the Conference on Disarmament, and the U.S. has been a block, obstacle to that. I think they have become a little more open. They have also been a little more open in the preliminary talks about the review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So maybe there is a slight, at least a cosmetic change in Washington, which we should welcome. There are lots of things that could be done to find again a détente and to continue as sort of a more peaceful direction after the end of the Cold War.
But hasn't there been talk about weapons in outer space,
yes,
which were banned by one of those treaties? Well, why is the United States interested in weaponizing space?
Well, this is a big issue, really, and it has been blocked for discussion in Geneva, both by the U.S. and by the U.K. The Outer Space Treaty that was concluded during the Cold War prohibited the stationing of any weapons of mass destruction in the outer space, but it doesn't prohibit the stationing of other weapons in outer space. And I think that U.S. military feel that they have they are so much ahead of other countries in space, and they don't want to lose any of that advantage by negotiations. But the Chinese shooting down a weather satellite of their own, I think, sent the signal that, look here, if we are going to have a race about space or about any conflict in space, then we too are able to inflict a lot of damage. And there is something almost, I think, surrealistic and perverse about this situation. We have armies of engineers who are improving our use of the mobile phones and the GPS and whatnot, and space is a tremendous civilian asset. At the same time, we have armies of engineers who are figuring out how can we destroy all this. And there's little public discussion about it, actually.
Most of the efforts by the UN Security Council to prevent Iran from going nuclear, such as stiff sanctions, have been vetoed by China and Russia. Is Iran being used as a proxy by other nations to counter a possible U.S. domination of the region?
I would not think so. I think that the Russians, who are neighbors of Iran, or nearly neighbors at any rate, or very close to them, that they are very interested in avoiding that Iran go for nuclear weapons, and they also appreciate that it would increase the danger in the Middle East. I think that they are, I don't think they are negative because they are helping to complete civilian nuclear reactors in Bushehr in Iran. I think it is more a feeling that this may be counterproductive, that the sticks do not help very much, and they have been fairly constructive in offering enrichment facilities for the Iranians in Russia, and they have also said that you don't need enrichment. We will deliver enrichment to the reactors you have, and we will take back the spent fuel, so there will be no reprocessing in Iran. I don't think one really should suspect the Russians of wishing to put up the Iran against the rest of the world, against the U.S.
I'm talking with Hans Blix. He wrote an article called Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Global Arms Control, for the Boston Review. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Could a country develop a nuclear capability without the rest of the world being aware of it?
That would be hard if they developed enrichment, because this requires fairly large installations. And in the case of Iran, of course, the IAEA did not see what was going on. The Iranians had not declared, and they didn't consider that they were obliged to do so. But eventually there were some whistleblowers who came out and reported on it. And I think that the combination of IAEA inspection and intelligence are fairly likely to discover what's going on. They discovered what went on in North Korea when the reprocessing plant was spotted. In the case of Libya, I think it was intelligence that discovered what was going on.
But what happened in Iraq? The United States and Britain made a case that convinced a lot of people that Saddam Hussein had a nuclear program, and it's quite obvious he didn't.
Yes, but on the other hand, of course, we have to admit that in the 1980s, and the Iraqis were able to develop quite a lot of installations without us seeing it in the IAEA, and that was due to the weakness of the safeguards, the verification system. Since then, a strengthening of the system has been worked out, and additional protocols have been adopted. They still remain to be ratified by a great many countries, including Iran and including the U.S., but nevertheless, the international system has got stronger tools to discover what's going on than they had in the past. The technique of investigation and verification took great steps forward during the Iraq during the sanctions in the 1990s. Such things as environmental sampling, for instance, gives a very powerful tool to discover what's going on.
Earlier this month, it was announced that the United States and Britain have circulated a new proposal to the members of the United Nations Security Council to terminate immediately the mandates of the weapons inspectors. Why has it taken so many years after their absence became a foregone conclusion?
Yeah, well, I was the chairman of that commission, so I should have some feelings about it. I mean, clearly we drew the conclusion that Iraq had actually destroyed practically all their weapons of mass destruction in 1991 already. But there were a great deal of things that were unaccounted for, and the UNMOVIC continued to work on trying to figure out what had happened to these things. The Security Council didn't need any further reassurance that the weapons are gone. But the Russians, I think, felt that the sanctions had begun with the Security Council, and it should not end by simply having a declaration from Washington that we have sent inspectors down there under Mr. Kay and Mr. Dulfer, and that's enough. The Russians, I think, wanted to have a declaration from the Security Council. Eventually, they didn't do that. They could not have done much more in the case of Iraq, and it's clear that they could not continue to live on the Iraqi oil for food money for their operations. They could have been transformed into something else, but that did not occur at this time. Maybe it will come sometime in the future. The Security Council will set up some rosters of inspectors that they could use.
Many nations are faced with the possibility of carbon-based energy sources like coal and oil being in short supply. And is it just too tempting if you're developing nuclear energy to run everything to go the next step towards gaining a capacity for nuclear weapons?
I don't think so. I think this is a bit exaggerated. People say that if we're going to have much more nuclear power in the world, then we will need more enrichment facilities, and that will be tempting. However, when we look at how things have happened in the history, we find that most countries that have nuclear weapons have gone for nuclear weapons first, and then they have gone for civilian nuclear power. And the North Koreans, clearly, they went in chief mainly for nuclear weapons. The Chinese had nuclear weapons long before they had civilian nuclear power. The Israelis have nuclear weapons and have no nuclear power. So it is, in my view, perfectly possible to have civilian nuclear power without nuclear weapons and vice versa. But we need the assurance that those who have enrichment, that they are not diverting any of the material for the weapons production.
Talking about North Korea, the Wall Street Journal recently reported on efforts by the United States to formally end the Korean War. It's now in its 54th year. Do you see that as a promising sign that your message is getting through to the people who make decisions in Washington?
Well, I think it would be a very good idea to do so, because as I said initially in our talk, the main reason that prompt countries to move towards nuclear weapons are perceived security. And the North Koreans, as I wrote in my article, are a little paranoid, perhaps for some reasons. And I think they need to have the reassurance that they will have diplomatic relations, that they will be assured against any attack from the outside. And settling the Korean War by a peace treaty would also go in the same direction. So creating security, the political action, is the primary defense against nuclear weapons, wherever you are, in Korea or elsewhere.
How concerned are you by the revelations that the father of Pakistan's nuclear program, Abdul Qadir Khan, was known to transfer nuclear technology to nations like North Korea without at least official government sanction?
Well, above all, he transferred it to Iranians, but also to Libya, maybe to others, we don't know. No, we are all have reasons to be very concerned about it, and it confirms what we know, namely that the knowledge is indestructible, and that how to make centrifuges is not something that you can forever bar from other countries. Export restrictions have a great role to play. They may retard, it may make it more difficult for potential proliferators, but it is not an absolute bar. And you can have figures like Mr. Khan who will play in this field, and one has to try as best one can to prevent that.
He could also do the same thing for terrorist organizations.
Conceivably, but if a terrorist organization wanted to build reprocessing or enrichment, that's a very big undertaking. I think most experts think it's very unlikely that they could succeed in that, and that it would be a little less likely unlikely that they could steal plutonium or steal a bomb or something like it. But our experience of the terrorists are not that they have been using weapons of mass destruction, but rather simple tools. The latest ones in London are just gasoline and tubes, which is not very advanced. On the other hand, there's no reason to be complacent about it. I mean, the risks are not zero. One has to take the precautions that one can. But the terrorists that used weapons of mass destruction were the Japanese ones. They used sarin in the subway in Tokyo. And perhaps chemical weapons would be the least unlikely that they would use.
Mr. Blix, in your article in the Boston Review, you write about the need for professional international inspection of nuclear facilities around the world by the UN and IAEA to help stop proliferation. But didn't your experience as a weapons inspector in Iraq show how difficult certification and inspection can be?
Well, yes, you have to acknowledge that you proving the negative is not possible. Very, very hard at any rate. What we did in Iraq was that we had a great many inspections. We had about 700 inspections in 500 different sites during a period of three and a half months, and we did not find any weapons of mass destruction. And we used suggestions from intelligence agencies, Washington, London, and others, to go to sites which they suspected. And in no case did we find any. And I think that everybody acknowledged that we were quite professional. We had very competent people doing it, so there'd be no criticism on that score. Yet we did not assert in March 2003 that there are no weapons of mass destruction. We simply said we have done all this, and we have not seen any signs of the weapons. Added to that then were the intelligence. And they had their sources. They had their defectors in particular. They were overhearing telephone calls and all that. And that is useful. But the difference is that the international inspectors are in nobody's pocket. They are international civil servants. They are not bending to U.S. or U.K. or Russian or any other interest. And that is a particular value. So I'm not arguing against the use of intelligence. I'm simply saying that there is a very great value in having international independent professional inspection.
And you also inspected all of the sites that the United States requested that you inspect. It wasn't as though you were ignoring any of that information that was coming from intelligence.
Well, we didn't have the time to go to all the sites that they have mentioned, but I think we went all in all to about three dozen sites that had been given to us by intelligence, whether U.S. or U.K. or others. And if we had been allowed to stay for a few months more, then we would have been able to go to them all. And since there weren't any weapons, we would have been able to say that in the spring of 2003.
Well, given the shifting rationales offered by the Bush administration about the Iraq war, do you think that it was all about weapons of mass destruction as it was originally posited?
No, absolutely not. I think that the reasons why they highlighted weapons of mass destruction, they might have believed in it. I'm not accusing them of bad faith. The reasons was that this was an argument that they could sell. It was the same thing with Blair in London. This was an argument that they could sell. If they simply said, we want to install in democracy in Iraq, I don't think that the Congress would have said that, yes, we will carry out a war for that. Or if they had said simply that we believe Al-Qaeda is there, I don't think it would have been enough. In fact, in the autumn of 2002, it was doubted by a great many people that Al-Qaeda were there, and we know since then that they were not there. Now they are there, but they were not there at the time. I think that oil had still, and it was an important part of it. The U.S. Was moving out the military contingency in Saudi Arabia, and they felt that they needed to have them present somewhere, and not only in the Gulf states, somewhere else. And Iraq has the second biggest oil resources in the Middle East. And moreover, if they could only get rid of Saddam, and hoping to get a government supportive of the U.S., they would also be close to Iran and then be able to keep a thumb on the Iranians. So while weapons of mass destruction was part of it, I don't doubt that. I think it was only one element among many.
And if you had been allowed to continue your inspections, you think that the war still might have proceeded?
I think it would be much more difficult, because if we had been to all the sites suggested to us by the U.S. and U.K. and others, and we have said that no, there is nothing, they must have realized that their sources were bad. And in particular, the bad sources were defectors. And it's been admitted by these people since then that they were not very honest in the suggestions they came. I'm a bit amazed that the intelligence, there are very professional people, that they accepted so many contentions by the defectors. It's a tragedy, and I mean, I can see only one good thing that come out of this war, and that is the disappearance of Saddam Hussein, because he was a horrible medieval tyrant.
Did you meet him? Did you have to deal with him personally?
Never. No, he would never deal with such lowly, creepy crawlies as Mohammed Abarday and myself.
Well, you don't seem so lowly to me. Hans Blix is...
But, I'm more, at present time, I'm more interested in what can we do now to move away from nuclear weapons. And I'm terribly interested in the discussion in the U.S. about in the presidential election about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I mean, I see, for instance, that Obama has said that he would like to see a bipartisan effort in Congress for a ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty.
I mean, now that the political winds have shifted because the Congress rejected it during the Clinton administration.
Right.
But so you can't be all that optimistic.
Well, in Congress, I think there are quite a few, actually, who would be interested in a ratification of Comprehensive Test Ban. And if that were to occur, then it would do very much to change the atmosphere. We see some other areas in which the U.S. Seems to be moving, and I mentioned the draft treaty on ending the production of enriched uranium and plutonium for weapons purposes. This is a U.S. draft, which is very much to the liking of the rest of the world and might also solve some of the problems in relation to India, provided that there was verification. You see, the U.S. cooperation with India under the draft nuclear agreement would enable India to use more of its own uranium for enrichment and making more bombs if there's no verification. And that could lead to an arms race with Pakistan and with China. But if there were a so-called cutoff agreement under which they would commit themselves, like the rest of the world, not to make enriched uranium for weapons purposes, then one might have a better chance to avoid that Pakistan and China went ahead and did the same thing.
Hans Blix is the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. He served as the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency from 1981 to 1997 and as the executive chairman of the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission from March 2000 to June 2003. His article, Nuclear Freeze, the Middle East and Global Arms Control, is in the May-June issue of Boston Review, which is a political and literary forum. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Bye-bye.